sensitive because...
Okay, could I have your attention? Welcome. My name is James Putzel, and I'm the director of the Crisis States Program of the Development Research Center. I'd like to welcome you all here today on behalf of the Development Studies Institute, DESTIN, and our Crisis States Program, which is funded by the Department for International Development of the UK government. Before I introduce the members of our panel, I want to say something about our topic, terrorism and the developing world, and tell you how we hope to proceed in the discussion. I feel I have to begin this session expressing both our deepest sorrow and our deepest indignation over the September 11th attacks on New York City and Washington, D.C., and our sympathy for all those who lost somebody dear to them in those attacks. Nothing can justify such an horrendous act. I would like to join state and non-state leaders and religious authorities of every denomination throughout the world in an unqualified denunciation of those who perpetrated that act. At the same time, I know the whole room also feels deep sorrow over the lives that are now being lost among both refugees and civilian casualties as the full force of military might is brought to bear against Afghanistan. We've been bold, or some might say foolish, in labeling this session terrorism and the developing world. The term is much abused, and since I'm responsible for introducing it in this session, I want to tell you what I mean by it. I see as terrorist action any kind of violence, and war in particular. But recognize these as blights on our civilization, which we must work to bring to an end by seeking out their causes and designing remedies, and doing so through systems of law at local, national, and international levels. Terrorism, by definition, lies outside our laws and deserves our condemnation. Despite our focus today on the developing world, terrorism is not a phenomenon that originated in today's developing world. Across Europe and North America, both state and non-state actors have committed acts of terror within their own boundaries or outside them throughout the last century, and sadly to say, into this new century as well. The term itself emerged out of the French Revolution, when the state used terror to consolidate its political authority. We think of Nazi Germany, and more recently, Serbia. We think of the contending sides in Northern Ireland. We think of the acts of terror perpetrated by Japanese forces throughout Southeast Asia during the Second World War, but also the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, perhaps the single most brutal act in recorded history designed to strike terror in the hearts of a nation. In our session this evening, among the central questions we are asking is what gives rise to terrorist organizations and activities in the developing world today? And why do they gain legitimacy in some communities and countries? This is a complex issue and still requires considerable research and analysis. I'd like to put three propositions to you and to the panel. First, I would suggest that increased terrorist activity emerging from organizations outside the state is a consequence of the weakening of states and state organizations, states unable to steer their people out of poverty and increased inequality, states unable to arrest destructive corruption, and state failures to rule by law and ensure security of the people and communities under their authority. States have been weakened in part by the negative impact of globalization, liberalization, and privatization, reducing their fiscal capacity and consequently their organizational capabilities to manage economic development and to organize accountable armed and police forces. In many parts of Africa, states have collapsed, leaving room for the rise of armed organizations regularly employing terror to achieve their ends. In the Philippines and Indonesia, weak states have provided a fertile terrain for armed organizations to pursue politics through kidnappings, assassinations, and other acts of terror. States have also been weakened by internal political failures, which in themselves, I would suggest, constitute the second reason for the growth and increased support for organizations that use terror in the pursuit of their political aims. I suggest that there has been a decided decline in programmatic politics, a decline in the pursuit of power through persuasion based on clear political party platforms for governance and economic management. Worldwide, the realm of political organizing has been denigrated through past failures of ideologically driven programs like socialism or the abuse of democratic pluralism, and through a consistent attack on the principles of secular politics, even in the world's most advanced democracies. Politics is portrayed not as a noble pursuit, but as riddled with corruption and self-seeking, self-interested abuse of power. This has created in many societies a political vacuum that allows the rise of sectarian organizations and increases the appeal of fundamentalist tendencies within them. The instrumentalism that accompanies fundamentalism of all varieties opens the way to justify any means by ultimate goals and creates an environment in which terror can be seen as a legitimate means to pursue political objectives. Finally, I would suggest that organizations that employ terror have gained legitimacy by the often cynical, hypocritical, and abusive exercise of power in the international realm by today's most developed democracies. Preaching the protection of rights at home, the military and intelligence organizations of the great powers have too often supported abusive regimes abroad, if in doing so they gain strategic military advantage or access to natural resources. The United States and other Western powers supported Osama bin Laden and his networks when they mobilized forces to fight the Russians in Afghanistan. For years, the Afghan people have suffered regimes that abused basic human rights and left a population mired in poverty, while external powers have been more willing to send arms to one group or another than to comprehensively address that suffering. One policy is adopted towards the abuse of Kurdish people in Iraq, while another is adopted when the same abuse is carried out by Turkey. The long condition of statelessness and hopelessness among Palestinians, tolerated by the international community, has provided legitimacy to organizations within Palestine that have turned to terror to pursue the quest for statehood. These abuses of power and this neglect weakens the moral authority of our democratic states on the world scene and creates a fertile terrain for organizations advocating terror and a rejection of the West and the agenda of good government and democracy it promotes in the developing world. With these thoughts in mind, I want to turn to our panel. And in order to ensure an efficient and orderly debate, I would ask you to submit your questions in writing. The stewards all around the room have question forms, so just raise your hand at any point when you want to have a piece of paper to write a question down, and we'll collect them. And I'll try to ensure that a representative sample of all the questions is put to our panel. Okay, so just raise your hands when you want a paper to write a question on. Now, I'd like to turn to our first speaker, Hale Afshar from York University, who's an expert on women in Islam, and we're very grateful that she could travel down to be with us tonight. Thank you.
Deprive you of this briefly. Yeah, thank you very much, and thank you for this very interesting introduction. I feel very concerned about the term terrorism. and its use of it. Because in my experience, in many cases in the Middle East and in much of the world, yesterday's terrorists happen to be today's freedom fighters and tomorrow's government. And it seems to me to draw a clear line, as seems to be the international community's intention at this point, is extremely problematic and, in my view, very, very difficult to justify. And I just give you an example. We are supposedly fighting terrorism by bombing Afghanistan because some Egyptians and Saudi citizens bombed America. Now, that seems to me a very curious roundabout way of dealing with terrorism. As far as I know, so far, none of the international agencies have found a single Afghan actually active as a terrorist in the West. And so to actually use the justification of terrorism in order to terrorize the Afghans seems to me extremely problematic. And so I would like to put it to you that we do have a quandary. And I think that quandary is actually very typical of the experiences of the Middle East over the past century, and it looks like, sadly, over the next century. I think, in some sense, many people tried, and I have had too many futile discussions with academics, who argued that there is something about us Middle Easterns which makes us constitutionally, culturally, and ideologically unable to cope with democracy, with representation, with good governance, with all the kind of words and verbiage which is so common in the West. Well, I don't think so. But I think that you know, it is a simplistic way of dismissing what has been a very complex history in the past century, and it looks like in the present century. Now, there are ways of looking at the experiences of the Middle East which could actually explain the process. I think one of them, and the simplest one of all, is just a three-letter word, oil. I think if we think of resources, if we think of who produces it, who consumes it, how it gets there, and how it is very much in the interest of the minority of the people who live in the West to use as much oil as they possibly can, as cheaply as they possibly can, you can actually see a process which seems to justify the interference which the Middle East has experienced throughout the 20th century and looks like experiencing right now. And that actually is explained in the old style analysis of imperialism, which I think actually had a great deal to say, which was extremely valid and extremely important. And actually, to just tell you a very good illustration of the process, today I read in the papers that the mayor of New York refuses a $1 million or $10 million, beg his pardon, donation by a Saudi prince. Because after a long spiel about how wonderful the Americans were, he also happened to criticize what the American policy is doing to the Middle East. Now, these are the same Americans who are bombing Afghanistan, both with missiles and with food. Now, why is it? Why is it that what is not okay for the Americans is okay for the Afghans? That also worries me. Similarly, why is it that a nation like Israel, which was born of terrorism and of freedom fighters, of the new government, the kind of definitions I gave you earlier, can do no wrong? And yet, when the British Foreign Secretary mentions the nation of Palestine, who happens to be an occupied nation, he's ostracized and the British have to apologize. Why is there one law for one people and another for another? Now, it seems to me that if we actually have an understanding of fairness, however limited concept of fairness, if we have an understanding of justice, of equality, then it's very hard to say that the people who oppose this kind of unequal force are terrorists. In my view, they have to fight for a cause. Now, there is in this opposition to the force a conception that Muslims the world over have somehow united against the West, and they have done so as the whole community of terrorists. Now, I must say that I'm very, very grateful to many politicians in the UK for actually dissociating themselves from such an assumption and for making a distinction amongst Muslims, those who are for and those who are against. But in the last 5 minutes that remains for me, I will just give you a brief explanation as to why possibly young men who are affluent, who are middle class, who are well brought up, who are highly educated, choose to use themselves as a missile, choose to destroy the very society from which they have benefited. And the young men who have so far been identified as terrorists are actually the crème de la crème. They are the best that their societies can produce. And that actually includes Osama bin Laden, which we could actually discuss, if you wish, in the subsequent discussion. Now, partly, this is because there is a conceptualization that Muslims have of themselves as a single community, as the Ummah, as the peoples of Islam. And the conceptualization is that the peoples of Islam recognize no color, no boundary, no nation state as constructed in the 20th century, and have a commitment to work as a group, as one. And this sense of unity is anchored in 1,000 years of rule by the Caliphate, where in fact the governance of Islam ruled from Poitiers to Southeast Asia, where people as groups have identities, but in fact they are united in their adherence to the laws and the prescription of Islam without minorities having no right. Again, in this kind of contestation between Islam and Christianity, there is a false paradigm in which some Muslims are also contributing to this, who they forget that in fact the Quran accepts all religions of the book which preceded it. And this actually leads me to the great discussion that is being made of the Quran, because the community of Muslims accept the Quran as the word of God. And I'm very pleased that the Prime Minister of Britain is traveling with the Quran and the Bible at the same time, and that the Quran has actually come to the fore. I'm very, very pleased about that. But there is a problem about the Quran. And the problem is, who has the right to actually interpret the Quran? And there is a school of thought, generally expounded by men and for men, that only men of scholarly achievement have the right to read the Quran and translate it. And these men have forgotten that at the inception of Islam, there were very worthy women who actually were in the forefront of interpretation of the Quran. But what men have done for some dozen of centuries or so is they have constructed a system, a university system, in which you have to go through the process of being indoctrinated by your tutors, and then they give you a degree, like we all do to our students. Some of my students are here, they know what I'm talking about. And they give you ijazah, they give you permission to actually translate and understand the Quran as you please. Now, this was very problematic, because in fact, women were excluded from this process. And so in the 20th century, women have actually asked to get the right to access the text of the Quran. And so have many other Muslims across the world. And so when people give us fatwas, when people tell us that we have to go on holy war, when people tell us whatever they do, and they're usually men, we as Muslims argue that in Islam there are no intermediaries between people and God. We have taken the right, not only as women, but also as believers, to actually decide for ourselves what is the right path, what we should do and what we shouldn't do. And as one such person, I can tell you that Osama bin Laden's approach is un-Islamic, and no one needs to follow him. Thank you.
I would now like to call on Denise Candiotti from the Development Studies Center at SOAS, just up the road. And I do want to just apologize publicly to Denise for misspelling her name on the publicity. It's Denise, D-E-N-I-Z, which I'm told in Turkish means sea, which I think is lovely. And forgive me, I'll always remember that now. Thanks, Denise.
Thank you, James. I think I'd like to take two quotes that I've seen over the last few weeks as the starting point for my reflections today. The first is by Arundhati Roy, who wrote in The Guardian, and where she says, "Terrorism has no country. It's transnational, as global an enterprise as Coke, Pepsi, or Nike." The second is Barnett Rubin, writing on Afghanistan, who says, "Terrorists are able to have bases because they articulate grievances felt by millions of people who are not terrorists." Now, on the face of it, these two quotes seemingly pull in opposite directions, but I think they're in fact complementary because they articulate the global and the local roots of the diverse phenomena loosely grouped under the label of terrorism. Today, what I would like to do is to very much focus on the local and to argue that, contrary to appearances, and especially appearances on your television screens recently, it is not universal ideologies and calls to jihad that mobilize people, but the combination of very specific local contingencies with international flows of funds and arms. In particular, I want to argue that what conditions and facilitates the recruitment of individuals and groups to movements using armed insurrection and acts of terror is the prior breakdown of political legitimacy and the rule of law. The colonization of spaces created by networks of patronage and protection presided over by strong men is a well-known phenomenon. The capture of these networks by organized armed groups corrodes the fabric of society to such an extent that the political process becomes the hostage of these forces. This is the sad fate visited on Pakistani society as a result of its sponsorship of the Taliban, backed by CIA finance and the drugs trade. I would like to bring into focus some of my own experiences here because my own work, my field work, has been in an area of Central Asia adjoining Afghanistan, which has become sadly notorious as a recruiting ground of the IMU, the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, which is now listed as a bin Laden franchise. I have been witnessing since 1997 in that area growing land hunger, crumbling social safety nets, and the very rapid growth of an informal economy, which despite its largely licit nature, also involves many illicit activities. Traders constantly cross the border to sell their goods in Osh and in Jalalabad. The forces of law and order, the traffic police, the border police, which have not been receiving wages, I must say, for a long time, are all on the take. Farmers are subjected to all sorts of exaction, and much of their produce goes to paying bribes to bazaar officials or to the police. It makes sense to seek protection, to become clients of local bosses who have much longer standing accommodations with the forces of law and order. One such strong man where I worked was a devout Muslim, and he was on the wanted list of the government. He eventually fled to Tajikistan. There were murmurings about his wealth having something to do with narcotics, but he was a good man, they said. Who else could you turn to for money if your child got sick, if you needed to send somebody somewhere to study, if you were suddenly short of cash for your son's wedding? The villagers in that region do not know very much about the great Satan or the West. Indeed, they are more exposed to Bollywood than to Hollywood. I have sat through so many Russian-dubbed Indian movies which broke into songs in Hindi. It was amazing. And they tend to watch, and they tend to watch Russian television because of the language barrier. But what they do know is that there are no jobs for the young. Some are crossing over the border to join their former benefactor. Some of their faces are now pasted all over the walls of the provincial and local administrations. And some of these faces, to my surprise, were female in some provinces. Their jihad is not against some distant West, but against increasingly desperate local conditions. I will end my contribution by saying, the more we take the trouble to understand the microdynamics of terror in specific contexts, the less we will be tempted to use the loose talk of clash of civilizations, which have become the propaganda tools of Bush and Bin Laden. And I want to end here.
Thank you very much, Denise. I now would like to welcome to the LSE Zahir Tanin, who didn't have to come too far, up the street from Bush House, where he's a senior producer in the Persian service. And I gather also a medical doctor living in Afghanistan until the early 1990s. So thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you very much. First of all, I would like to say that whatever the causes of terrorism are, what happened in Afghanistan is that our ignorance led to a situation where Afghanistan became a very, very dangerous space for Islamic terrorism. As the BBC services involved, world service, I mean Persian service, is involved with daily covering of events in Afghanistan and in the region, I wanted to share only some thoughts on the question that what is likely to happen in Afghanistan as a result of this crisis. Today is the sixth day of air strike in Afghanistan, and there are signs of deployment of the ground forces. Yeah. Sorry for this.
It's not as well arranged as the studio.
This is the 6 days of the strikes, and at the same time there are signs of deployment of the ground forces in order to topple the Taliban regime and destroy the forces of Bin Laden. But it's clear, I think, the war cannot be won by bombardment or purely military means. A friend of mine a few days ago asked Carl Bildt, the former UN United Nations special envoy to the Balkans, if he thought that the Western experience in Bosnia and Kosovo might provide any lessons for Afghanistan. He thought for a minute and then said, politics first. I think Bildt's view is a modern rephrasing of an older dictum. War is politics pursued by other means, which is a famous phrase that belonged to Karl von Clausewitz, the Prussian general and military strategist. We know, and it's now clear, that Washington and London now, in my view, rightly understand that any struggle against terrorism which based on Afghan land cannot be won without addressing underlying causes of terrorism, which is the support that is provided by the Taliban regime for Osama bin Laden and its network. What we know from our own sources in Afghanistan is that the airstrikes are weakening the Taliban, and it's predicted the Taliban regime will begin to fragment under the continuing pressure in the near future. But the dismantling of the Taliban regime may not be helpful without placing a dynamic political strategy. The aim of this strategy, despite all vagueness about it, is clear enough: to replace the Taliban with a broad-based, multi-ethnic government in Afghanistan. And this is not an easy job. Any solution to the Afghan crisis, which is nurturing the terrorist networks centered in and around the Taliban regime, would involve at least three inseparable issues, in my view. First, the formation of a government that would have legitimacy at home and internationally. Secondly, the establishment of a security forces. And thirdly, the reconstruction of Afghanistan itself. These issues remain, in the view of many people, particularly contentious and will require care, resources, and thoughts. To develop an effective political strategy in Afghanistan for the sake of stopping terrorism, the United States and the United Kingdom, and generally the West, must pursue a coherent, thoughtful, and sustainable policy. Without that, any efforts will not lead to stop the terrorist activities in Afghanistan. This strategy may help to end the nightmare of the Taliban tyranny to the Afghan people and help to have an effective, stable, and legitimate government. These are the thoughts I just wanted to share with you. But at the same time, I would like just to add to the ideas raised here by my colleagues that I'm doubtful to see Afghanistan in the frame of Arab West or civilization class discourse. The simple fact is that a moderate Islamic country like Afghanistan is turned into fanatic ground where an alien group directed its guns against its own people. What is happening in Afghanistan is very different, and it is not to be seen in this context. And the other thing is, when we speak about bombardment, Afghan people, it would be also mistaken to not being able to make a distinction between the Taliban and Afghan people in Afghanistan itself. If you look at the Osama bin Laden's pre-recorded statement on last Sunday, there is no word of Afghanistan. There is no word of Afghan. He was speaking only about Palestinians, Iraq children, and he is in Afghanistan, and this is a land foreign to him in many, many ways. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next, I'd like to call on Matthew Fielden from the Development Studies Institute, who's also working on Afghanistan. He's going to give us some of the context in which that lies behind recent events there.
It's impossible to read.
I hope.
Nobody could read that.
So now it's time for a lecture.
Okay.
Thank you. I'd like to think that what I say here in the next 5 minutes picks up on two things that Denise and Zahir have said, Denise mentioned understanding the microdynamics of terror. So what I'm hoping to do here is just to embellish perhaps the knowledge that exists in public debate about the Taliban and Afghanistan. There's a lot of information out there at the moment. So, and in fact, in a sense, there are so many issues thrown up by September the 11th in the context of Afghanistan that what I can tell you is obviously very limited, but I've just tried to present here on this overhead, which obviously some of you here can't see, the kind of highlights of the last 7 years of the Taliban in Afghanistan, to tell you a little story of Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, the Taliban, Afghanistan, to help you understand perhaps a little clearer. And in a sense, this may be an obituary for the Taliban, given the bombing which is occurring now, and a bombing which I have to say I'm fully opposed to. So if you look at this timeline, 94 is when the Taliban emerged out of a period of immense instability in Afghanistan. These people I've mentioned, Dostum and Hikmatyar, in this coup, it's basically a period of intense civil war in which Pakistan, it has to be said, was trying to seek a solution that was fitting with its national interests. Hence this mention of the Pakistani goods convoy. This is interesting because this is the very first mention there is in public debate of the Taliban when this goods convoy went to Pakistan from Turkmenistan. The Taliban freed this goods convoy and went on to capture Kandahar. Moving on, again, some of these events are just to show the tensions that have existed between the more militant aspects of the Taliban and the more pragmatic aspects of the Taliban. Hence, in 95, the Taliban killed a leader of an opposition group. Mullah Omar, the leader of the Taliban, was elected as ruler in 96, in April 96, the year in which the Taliban went on to capture Kabul in September of that year. It's interesting to then note that at this period, the Taliban was actually viewed as, in the words of Robin Raphael, who was the assistant US Secretary of State for South Asia, a potentially positive force. So there was some optimism at this time. The Taliban was seen to be bringing some kinds of peace and security within Afghanistan. It's also interesting that in March 97, Osama bin Laden, again, this is in public domain, was first linked to the Taliban regime. And in May, the Taliban then moved on to take more territory, Mazar Sharif. And this was a very destructive phase again, with alleged allegations of 2,000 Taliban massacred when they failed to take this town. What's so interesting internationally was it was then that Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and UAE recognized the Taliban. Then in 98, there were these embassy bombings, which were linked by the Americans to bin Laden. You can see that the bombings occurred on August the 7th, and on the 20th, there were the US cruise missile strikes. It's interesting there could be a link somehow into the domestic politics of Afghanistan that the Taliban then finally took control of Mazar Sharif a day after these embassy bombings in 97. Again, at 98, again, I apologize, some of this detail may be flowing over people's heads. Relations went down with the Saudi Arabians September. The Saudis recall their charge d'affaires, and the Taliban become more defiant. And it's really this transition from 94 to 98. You could say that there were many people holding out some kind of hope for the Taliban as a political movement with Afghanistan, but then increasingly they become a more radical and a more militant movement. And that's not to say there haven't been, they've showed other faces as well, but there are events between 98 and 2001 which show an increasingly vitriolic face. So in 99, again, the Americans are still looking for Osama bin Laden, and he's alleged to have disappeared, according to the Taliban. It's then interesting that in 99, and I think this was a key missed moment by the international community, that the UN managed to get this watershed power-sharing agreement between the Taliban and the Northern Alliance. And there's this thing called 6+2 in July 1999, which is basically the regional powers plus Russia and America had agreed on a peaceful settlement. So it seemed to be in place, but the feeling is that some of that energy was lost because there wasn't enough concerted international pressure or attention, in a sense, to bring a solution to this situation. So then again, it was scuppered. The Taliban launched a military offensive. There's an interesting event in August of 1999 when Mullah Omar, there was an attempt on his life, which is very hard to read, and this shows how difficult it is to understand the dynamics within the Taliban. And then the UN bring in this resolution in October demanding that the Taliban turn over bin Laden. So in a sense, what I'm trying to say here is that what you're seeing now in the media since September the 11th is in many ways an extension of a lot of processes that have been going on for a while in Afghanistan. Then in March of 2000, the OIC, Organization of the Islamic Conference, convened some talks, which are regarded as being potentially successful, but then they failed. And then again, this final run-up to where we are now with this increasing radicalization, mid-July 2000, so mid-July last year, there was a decree on female employment, which restricted female employment quite heavily in Afghanistan. And then another resolution from the UN, and then 2 minutes, right? I'm there, I'm to 2001 now, 7 years in 7 years in 7 minutes. 2001, the Bamiyan Buddhas were destroyed. Again, the sense of the radical face of the Taliban appearing. But again, even at the time, there was this sense that the Taliban was showing a pragmatic face as well. As with May 2001, it seemed that the opium ban that the Taliban had offered may be taking effect. And then just the last few weeks, Massoud, that was a major event, being assassinated. Obviously then the WTC attacks and then these attacks on the Taliban beginning at the beginning of the week. That's all I'd like to say, really, but if I'd open myself up to questions if anyone would like any more detail explained in the context of this debate, and I'd leave the analysis to the other speakers. And I'll leave you with some events that I think are very important but are not at the centre of international attention at the moment, and that's the Saudi connection to all of these events. As has been mentioned, the majority of the, according to the FBI, of the people who took part in this attack were Saudi nationals. And I think Saudi Arabia plays a key role in understanding the Taliban as a movement and in the politics of Afghanistan. I'll just change the OHP, and that will be my contribution.
Thank you. Remember, if you have any questions that are already coming to you, please raise your hand so that you can fill these out and we can get on to the questions once our speakers are finished. I'd now like to call on David Keane from the Development Studies Institute here, who has written on wars in Africa and Sudan and Sierra Leone, and he's going to give us his reflections this afternoon. Thank you, David.
Thank you. I'm not an expert on terrorism or Afghanistan, although James has defined terrorism sufficiently broadly, I think, that I become an expert on it. A lot of my views, I think, could be predicted from an article which Polly Toynbee published yesterday. And I think, to be honest, I'm an admirer of hers, but I think she should know better than to make the distinction, which she did, between hard liberals who favor a muscular, vigorous approach to the current military crisis, and what she calls limp liberals who go on about peace and have no particular solutions to offer. I fall into the category of limp liberal, according to her definition. I want to say a bit about this idea of a war on terror, you know, which is really sort of beamed at us in a way 24 hours a day on Sky News and BBC News 24 with their strap lines and so on. I think a lot of people can be quite happy with this idea of a war on terror, and I'm not certainly the first to say this, but some of them are indeed the terrorists. Now, terrorists on the whole seek the status of war, and the idea of a war on terrorism is giving them in a way what they want. The IRA has always tried to frame its actions within the framework of war, and my own view is that it is better to call these things crime and try to prosecute accordingly, which obviously raises the question of how you get hold of people, which is where I think Polly Toynbee would begin her criticism. Now, it is, I'm very uneasy, for example, with Tony Blair's speech, which was very impressive in some ways. He seemed to be aiming for a certain kind of new world order, but ignoring an organization which is supposed to, in a way, embody this, the United Nations. It's clear that Blair, in a way, is talking about a world where the United States and the United Kingdom, in particular, take a lead on major international issues and to some extent, operate as world policemen. I think what there is a failure of imagination here, to put it mildly, because in a sense it is this arrogation of power, this arrogation to yourself of the right to define what injustices count and what should be punished and what should be left unaddressed, which has made the United States in particular often very unpopular and even hated. I think the food drop which has been mentioned, if we imagine that, let's suppose that Osama bin Laden was behind the destruction of the World Trade Center, if we imagine that that act was accompanied by the dropping from 20,000 feet of small food rations on, for example, the homeless people in Chicago. I mean, in a way, it's a serious point. Would we then turn around and say, okay, he has no problem with the American regime, with the American people, sorry. He has no problem with the American people. It's the regime that he's after. And I think, in a way, the answer is not. But the surprising thing is that we could actually sort of believe that other people would think differently. And I think that, you know, when Fanon was writing about violence, it's worth in some ways going back to some of his insights. He did realize, in a way, that you could use violence to bring out a certain kind of underlying racism on the part of the people that you're using violence against, and use it to win support as that racism became more evident. And this is part of how terrorism, I think, works. And in some ways, I think it is working. So let me just say, John Prescott said that this was a week or so ago. It's part of building the coalition against terrorism is assisted by the fact that a lot of governments have their own terrorist problems, so they are interested in the suppression of terrorism. And this of course is true. What I think we have to be aware of, or what I want to emphasize, is that war and the language of war, in a way, is partly about generating legitimacy for certain kinds of violence and oppression and exploitation. These become legitimate within the confines of a broader struggle. Now, this struggle has been variously defined at different points in history. Not so very long ago, the location of evil, we were asked to believe, was in the Soviet Union. So the overriding framework for war or Cold War was a war against the Soviet Union. And there was a process here of building coalitions against evil, of recruiting governments in Africa and many parts of the world that would join, as it were, your side in the battle against evil. I think one of the things that we need to remember is that in the course of that process of coalition building, you know, how do you build a coalition like that? One of the ways is you can distribute money or largesse or military resources to your coalition partners. Another important way is that you are willing to turn a blind eye to the internal abuses that are carried out by your coalition partners. And this is, for example, the case I know best was a big part of the cover-up of Sudan, of famine in Sudan in the 1980s, when Sudan was regarded as an ally in the Cold War against the Soviet Union. Now, I think in the course of this, after the Cold War, we had the war on drugs. That was another, in a sense, a great crusade. I know crusade is a dangerous word. but I'm okay in this case because it's against drugs. So, that was a campaign where a lot of governments, realizing that this was now on the international agenda, positioned themselves in this international war on drugs, and were able to appropriate it and utilize it as a kind of a counterinsurgency tool and an instrument of political repression. Now, I think this coalition that's been built, and it does seem to be a very fragile one, in this war against terrorism, as defined by the United States and the United Kingdom in particular, is already creating the political opportunities for certain actors, like, for example, the Russian government in relation to the Chechens, like the military government in Pakistan, and so on, like the Sudanese government in relation to the southern Sudan, for securing a degree of impunity for internal repression in the context of that new collective definition of where evil resides. And I think we have to... Robert Kaplan wrote a recent article in Washington Post. He said, even our vision of democracy must now undergo subtle realistic alteration. Rather than demand that countries like Pakistan, Egypt, and Tunisia democratize, we will have increasingly to tolerate benign dictatorships and various styles of hybrid regimes, provided that they help in our new struggle. I mean, that was certainly his most moderate point that he made, but it's still quite a worrying one. He says that we need a little bit of evil. George Bush must do some evil in order that greater evil can be prevented. If we take a broad definition of terrorism, you know, like the one that James has suggested, in many ways I think that's a radical act because it's challenging, for example, Blair and Bush in their definition of terrorism, which is highly particular. And in fact, I say their definition of terrorism, they will go to great lengths not to define terrorism for a number of reasons which will be clear to you. But I think it also, in a way, risks bracketing any rebellion as terrorism, since most rebellions actually use terror in some form. And there is, I think, a danger that suppression of rebellion and suppression of dissent in general is going to be a lot easier and have a cover of legitimacy within the context of this international war against terrorism. Now, in the case of Sierra Leone, this is a different kind of terrorism, but definitely the use of terror against civilians, as James mentioned. I think that the RUF, the rebels there, have systematically used terror in pursuit of power and wealth. But what strikes me most forcibly is that this has actually proven, it's actually proven useful for a whole range of groups in Sierra Leone to be able to point to the RUF as the source of evil in the country, and meanwhile pursuing a variety of political and economic ends, including the suppression of democracy under the cover of war. The RUF terror has served a function, in a way, as that which we can all condemn and behind which we can all do what we want. In a sense, the rebellion has created a kind of climate of impunity for those who are prepared to mouth the right words against the source of evil that has been collectively identified. And that's a danger which I want to to highlight. Maybe I'll leave it there.
Very good. Thank you, David. If anybody wants to see these OHP projections, then we'll put them on the Crisis States website, which you can find through the Destin website. Now, finally, I'd like to call on Professor John Harris, who's the director of the Development Studies Institute, and if he doesn't get embarrassed at me saying this, I think one of the leading figures in development studies in this country and certainly internationally as well. So, John, thanks very much for taking up the rear.
Right, I'd like, first of all, to thank my fellow speakers on the panel for not entirely anticipating things that I thought I might say. In fact, I want to speak principally about the wider context and significance of terrorism, situating it in relation to imperialism, a word which, like Halle, I'm not ashamed to use, and globalization. And I, in a way, I think I'm coming back to the, many of the themes with which James started. September the 11th was a significant date in the recent history of the world before this year. One anniversary which falls on September the 11th is that of the signing of the Camp David Accords by Anwar Sadat of Egypt and Menachem Begin of Israel, orchestrated by President Jimmy Carter. That agreement saw the capitulation of Egypt and the isolation subsequently of the Palestinians. It's a reminder to us, I think, of the significance for current events, of the question of Palestine and of the rights of Palestinians to their own state, only very grudgingly and recently acknowledged by the United States. And it reminds us of the by now long history of state-sponsored terrorism perpetrated by Israel against Palestinians. September the 11th also was the date of the overthrow in 1973 of the social democratic regime of Salvador Allende in Chile in a coup headed by Augusto Pinochet, which also heralded a savage period of state-sponsored terrorism in that country. The complicity of the US through the CIA in these events and the fairly active involvement of the Nobel Peace Prize winner Henry Kissinger is by now fairly well established in these events. This reminds us of the extent to which Western powers, notably the United States, but also Britain and France, both of them constrained more by resources than by intention, have intervened in the affairs of other countries and actually been ready to sponsor terror as a tactic against those whom they've seen as enemies. The role of the CIA and the creation of Osama bin Laden and of the Al-Qaeda network, and though perhaps less directly, in the creation of the Taliban has by now come to be widely recognized. The United States, the West in general, has of course pursued a cynical foreign policy, nowhere more than in the Middle East, where, as Halle pointed out, crucial oil interests are at stake. A foreign policy based on the principles of so-called realism, propounded very eloquently by Henry Kissinger in his academic writing, though sometimes dressed up in the language of idealism, the defense of freedom. And the enemy we're now fighting, we're told we're fighting terrorism, is to an important extent a creature created by Western imperialism, headed up by the US. Terrorism, I say, is a kind of a Frankenstein, born of the defeat of secular and socially progressive forces of the left across so much of the world, and secondly, of the general decline of programmatic politics to which James referred. The defeat of the left has long been pursued as an object of policy in the context of the Cold War. It began, in fact, in Europe in the later 1940s, when the United States brought about not only the reconstruction of the continent via the remarkable Marshall Plan, but also contributed to the defeat of left-wing parties that, as in Germany, had initially been strong in the aftermath of the Second World War. In the years that followed, the same policy was pursued across the world, sometimes by covert means, as in Chile in 1973, or through support for regimes like that of the late Nguyen Phan Chu in Vietnam, or of organizations like the Contras in Nicaragua. In Iran, the destruction of the secular revolutionary left by the CIA-sponsored regime of the Shah created a political space taken over by Islamists. In Afghanistan in 1979, the resistance led by rural religious leaders to the socialist Afghan government's decision to make education mandatory for women provided US intelligence with an opportunity to contrive another campaign against the left, with the consequences, the empowerment of the Mujahideen and the collapse of Afghanistan into warlordism that have contributed so largely to the present crisis and to other crises around the world. I think in particular of the spillover effects of the long war in Afghanistan, in Kashmir, where the Kashmiri people's own struggle for self-determination has been compromised by the intervention of religious fighters from outside. Of course, it would be simplistic to ascribe the defeat of secular and socially progressive political forces across the world entirely to the success of the operations of Western intelligence agencies. Their limitations were, after all, made all too plain in the destruction of the WTC. The left has very often contributed significantly to its own demise through its own internecine conflicts. Trends in the global economy have also played a significant part. The last quarter century or so has seen the rapid development of what some describe as a new regime of accumulation characterized by flexibility. This has involved the decline of the organized working class in the industrialized countries, as many areas of production have been informalized and short-term and part-time employment become extensive, while the new global division of labor has seen the expansion of casual employment rather than of organized employment in poor countries as well. These economic trends, then, developments in the organization of production of goods and services, are associated directly with the weakening of class projects, with their class politics, with their social change. The current epoch has seen the rise in their place of a kaleidoscope of the so-called new social movements. These are mostly single-issue movements around gender, environmental, or specific economic issues, such indeed as the movement we saw supported by farmers and truckers in this country at this time last year for lower fuel prices. They had no project of social change, they just wanted cheaper gas. And these social movements have usually made demands upon states rather than having projects of comprehensive social change. Amongst them are ethnic, nationalist and religious movements like the Muslim Brotherhood or the Hindu nationalist movement in India. Who supports these sorts of religious-based movements? If I may judge from the one I know best, the Hindu nationalist movement in India, mass support comes partly from somewhat educated young men whose aspirations have been frustrated as a result of the failures of the modernizing developmental state. It's these sorts of men, and some women too, who've participated in acts of terror directed against Muslims or latterly against Christians. But Hindu nationalism, and I believe comparable Islamic movements, as Halle also said, are supported by members of the middle classes. The reasons for their support include their own sense of the frustrations of failed modernity and their feelings that for their country to take its rightful place in the world, they must become in some way more truly themselves by being true to their own religious and cultural traditions. This is the economic, political and cultural context for the emergence of movements which are so hostile to the West and to modernity itself as to be committed to acts of terror against it. It is a context of failed development. I'll take one more minute.
All right.
Just one more piece in the jigsaw puzzle I'm putting together, which is another aspect of globalization. This term for me, whatever else it may mean, refers to an ideology, one which seeks to legitimate the pursuit of neoliberal economic policies. These policies include those associated with so-called structural adjustment, which has often entailed the curtailment of social expenditure on social services. Isn't it a salutary thought, then, that part of the reason for the importance of Islamic schools, the madrasas in Pakistan, the schools that gave birth to the Taliban, is actually a crisis in public education related in part to Pakistan's experience of structural adjustment. An American expert, Stephen Cohen, a Defense Department analyst, estimates that only about 12% of the madrasas have actually produced recruits for the Taliban. Many of the rest actually provide a better education than alternatives available in the public system. But this means, of course, that there will be many. For example, and this may be crucial for forthcoming events, in the middle ranks of the Pakistan army who are likely to be sympathetic to Islamic fundamentalism. I find it extremely ironic, then, that both G.W. Bush in the United States and Tony Blair here should regard faith-based schools rather favorably. A last word, if James allows me, and it will be just a moment. Somewhere at the heart of the long wars that have torn Afghanistan apart is a struggle over the place of women in society. We should remember that we have abundant evidence of the importance of female literacy for development. It's been shown, for example, in a fascinating reworking of Robert Putnam's celebrated analysis of social capital in that country, that levels of female literacy in the different parts of Italy in 1871 very substantially explain variations in levels of economic development, of government performance, and in the development of civil society by the end of the 19th century and even at the end of the 20th. Now it's claimed by some, and I think, David, I'm showing that I may be a hard liberal, not a limp one, it's claimed by some that for women to be secluded and denied even basic education is part of another culture and that outsiders have no right to question its precepts. But who, I ask, following Halle, defines the precepts of a culture? Cultures are always in the process of being contested, usually against the dictates of old men, like me. I do believe that members of different cultures have, as it were, a right to non-interference, but only, I suggest, on condition that they allow for free and rational debate within the group about the precepts of the culture. So at last, then, I join hands, I think, with Halle and with Denise in repudiating completely this notion of the clash of civilizations, which anyway rests on an essentialized notion of civilization, which is frankly untenable. Thank you.
Hey, I'm a bit overwhelmed by the questions. And it would be a major project for me to really sort them out in such a short period of time. So you're going to have to forgive me. And maybe what we might do is find a volunteer who could type up all these questions and put them on the website, and then you can all try to answer each other. I would suggest, since it's just the beginning of term, though I'm not involved in the teaching program this year, that perhaps some of you want to improve your penmanship before examination time. Yes? On the other hand, I have some very complicated questions that even have footnotes in them. So I'm just going to do my best. Okay. First of all, and I think given the state of current events, I would like to read out a few questions that are directly related to Afghanistan. We have questions on every aspect of what's been said here. We have criticisms that our panel was too one-sided, too biased, certainly there are going to be many fora in which the issues that we've raised here today are going to be debated here at the school, including further fora that we'll create ourselves in the Crisis States program. But let me first put some of the questions about, maybe three of the questions about Afghanistan. Okay.
Will Afghanistan only be accepted into the modern world order if its new infrastructure is in line with Western liberal democracy? Or could it be supported by the Islamic states in the world and adopt a similar infrastructure to Iran, a sort of theodemocracy? Let me just read out a few of these so that you can reflect on them. Concerning the Northern Alliance, are they really the right ones to be supported? Would they bring a better system to the Afghan society? As far as I know, they are not better than the Taliban. For example, concerning the role of women, perhaps you could give a profile of the Northern Alliance.
Good, in 2 minutes.
Yeah. I just want to, it's, okay. I totally disagree with the bombing of Afghanistan. It is illegal and wrong and shows the break between aims and means in eradicating terrorism. There has been a deafening silence in the mainstream media on alternatives to violence, reprisals. Can the panel comment on peaceful legal means to bring bin Laden to justice and end terrorism? So let me start with you, Zahid, to begin to answer some of these.
Thank you very much. It is very difficult to answer all these questions and here. The question of what kind of government in Afghanistan should be established, or what kind of government we would like to see in Afghanistan, it's a difficult question. I would like to say that the Afghans are poor, but they have a sophisticated notion of legitimacy. It is very important. What is needed at first, that there will be a kind of legitimate government, I mean internally and internationally. It's also, I think, desirable to expect that a kind of democratic liberal government will appear in Kabul. But what is important and significant, that Afghans and I think Afghan neighbors need a kind of stable, relatively democratic, broad-based government which will represent all segments of the Afghan society. There was another question also sent to me related to this one. I think that if a government would be seen in Afghanistan and that is putting in place by foreigners, that is another problem. This is why I think the idea is to have a kind of transitional government which help to start a process from within, a kind of legitimate government will appear. Of course, nobody in Afghanistan wants to be seen as a protege, a foreign protege, but in the last 20 years, all regimes in Afghanistan, in a way, were exported to Afghanistan, or they were protege regimes, or there were protege elements in these governments. At this moment, the idea is to have a national government in Afghanistan which represent all parties. This would take a form of a form of modern government rather than an Islamic government, which was asked. But it would be difficult for me, for anyone else, to at this time to speak about the nature of this government, the form of this government, but the first thing is to have a kind of legitimate government in Afghanistan. That is all I can say at this moment. About Northern Alliance. There are many reports about Northern Alliance. There are human rights records. Some people would like to say that they have a bloody hand in this war. What happened in the last 20 years of war in Afghanistan, especially after 1992, that it is very difficult to say that any group in Afghanistan would have a record that can be acceptable here for us. It was a war that within many crimes happened, atrocities happened, people were killed, and I mean, some concerns about the role in the record of the Northern Alliance seem to be legitimate. But it is not only the Northern Alliance to speak about. I think today there was a report about the Taliban in the United Nations that the atrocities have done by the Taliban should be also taken into consideration in the future. I think the day may come that one day, as it happened in Yugoslavia, I mean in Serbia and in Balkan, that some people who were responsible for the atrocities in Afghanistan, to be judged. But in a situation like this, the idea is to bring all anti-Taliban forces in a front. And the Northern Alliance is the only existing real force in northern Afghanistan, in many parts of Afghanistan. When the idea is to topple the Taliban regime, Washington or London cannot ignore this people in Afghanistan. But they are representative of a big different minorities groups in Afghanistan. And then how you can have a government in Afghanistan where all people wouldn't be represented. It's a multi-ethnic country, and it's the question is not about the ethnicity. There are different political groups, there are different military groups, there are different other sections in the society, and if you have a kind of Northern Alliance government in Kabul, and the fear is that people who are supporting at this moment the Taliban, mainly Pashtun in southern Afghanistan, they may react angrily, and that will put any project for establishing of a national government in danger. That is one thing. The other question was about agreeing and disagreeing of bombing. Of course, nobody wants in Afghanistan to be bombarded. And there are two discourses here. One is a kind of solidarity with people in Afghanistan. The other one is the ideological trend with see this kind of actions, military intervention, as a form of intervention in the internal affairs of other countries. I don't want to enter in this kind of academic discussion, but the only problem is if somebody I think criticized us for not representing other sides. I don't want to be seen as opposing to the Taliban, but I think in the view of many Afghans, they are responsible for the problems happen here, and they have this regime deprived women from life. I mean, this regime did a lot of atrocities, and if the idea is to topple this regime, then despite saying here that there were some moments or opportunities missed, but the idea is, in my our experience with Afghanistan, is that it was very, very difficult to replace the Taliban or to topple the Taliban regime without forcing them to go out. But this is not supporting the idea to bomb Afghanistan. And I say that politics first.
Thank you. Matthew, did you want to briefly add something?
Thanks, James. Yeah, I'll just briefly pick up on those three questions. In terms of the Northern Alliance, I think the question was pitched, are they a better system? I think the key is to understand that every Afghan I've spoken to will call themselves an Afghan. And although this conflict may be displaying apparent symptoms of an ethnic conflict. People are now talking about Tajiks, Pashtuns, Hazaras. I think it's good to focus on what brings Afghans together. So, as has already been made, every faction and every side in Afghanistan, in a sense, has strengths and weaknesses. But I do think that the Northern Alliance were in control of cities in Afghanistan between 92 and 94, and there was an enormous amount of violence inflicted upon these cities. And in some senses, that explains the emergence of the Taliban in 1994 as a force to pacify the country. Related to that is this moot question about whether Pashtuns can live under a non-Pashtun leadership. And this is a very difficult question and a contentious one to pursue in Afghanistan. If you look at the regimes historically in Afghanistan, other than in 1929, since 1747, it's been basically Pashtuns who have ruled the country, although Tajiks have been part of the administration, etc. So there are lots of issues to play out. The new infrastructure, I think, America has played its hand now. They want to take apart. Colin Powell has said it. He wants to identify and rip up. And this is Colin Powell, who is relatively, dovish in comparison to some other people in the American administration. That they seem to be wanting to take apart the Taliban. But equally, I don't see that they have an exit strategy from the bombing campaign in terms of a realizable future. And I think another window had been missed in terms of prior to this bombing and prior to September the 11th, there had been a lot of motions and movements being made in terms of looking beyond the Taliban. I think the Taliban got stuck. It was a 3 to 4 year period where they were viewed positively, and then they lacked this sense of vision. And basically, you have to understand, obviously, that Afghanistan is an incredibly poor and impoverished country, and there are 50,000 Talibs, and there are 20 million Afghans, and their priorities are basic: food and shelter and education and healthcare. And if the Taliban's not delivering on that, then they're not getting the domestic legitimacy, although obviously this is in the context of ongoing conflict. And lastly, alternatives to violence. I think this is the most important question, because it's all very well to take a more nuanced approach and to argue against the bombing, but I've seen the evidence that's in the public domain. I don't know the other evidence that the FBI and the CIA have. If bin Laden is responsible, then in that sense, I would argue very strongly for him to be brought to justice. I think declaring war on him, in a sense, would legitimate his position spuriously, rather than dealing with it as a criminal act to be dealt with criminally. But to extricate bin Laden from Afghanistan means answering the question, how much influence do Arabs within Afghanistan have on the Taliban movement, and what role can the OIC play, since they seem to be the only credible Islamic, pan-Islamic intergovernmental organization? What role can they play in extricating bin Laden? There was talk by the Taliban of handing over bin Laden potentially to the OIC. But it's this sense of now the West is stamping in around in the heart of some very, very delicate and highly militant Islamic institutions, organizations, and people. So the room for moderate debate is now hampered by, I would argue, by the bombing campaign.
Thank you. Thank you.
Just make a quick comment?
Yeah, very quick.
I mean, I think that the question of the establishment of legitimate government ultimately in Afghanistan is crucial to this. But for there to be a legitimate government in Afghanistan, it seems to me that internal legitimacy is the first essential. And that for there to be a government which has internal legitimacy, then it's extremely important that we stop people from that. Who are we? That to absolutely minimize interference from outside, from every quarter. I mean, if only outsiders had not armed the different fighting factions in Afghanistan and in other parts of the world in the first place. There will be conflicts in any society, but people have to sort out those conflicts to establish their own legitimate government. If there's more external interference there is, the less the chance of establishing legitimacy, it seems to me.
I think it's right, but one important thing to be reminded that in Afghanistan, at this moment, the only question is not the question of disarming people. Many interference have been done, and you can't see a kind of independent force in Afghanistan. All political forces, liberals, leftists, moderate nationalists, were forced to leave Afghanistan. They are in Europe, in the United States, in the region. And the only forces you can see inside Afghanistan is armed forces supported by one or other country. When you argue in European terms, let's speak with you, not academy, that the a nation should decide about themselves, it's okay, but without a kind of international presence to facilitate, to help these Afghans to come together and to prevent these regional mini powers, Pakistan, Iran, and others, to stop their this clientelism relationship. I mean, it is impossible to provide the ground for emerging a kind of national legitimacy. This is why, because this problem during the Cold War was created by the Cold War players. And now it should be ended by one of these players, which is now won, I mean the United States. Without the international support, of course, it is impossible to establish a government. And then, of course, you're right, you're absolutely right, that if any government in Afghanistan will be seen as a creator of foreign forces, then it will lose the legitimacy. How it should be done, the UN can play an important role.
Okay. Thank you, Zahir. Okay, I just want to put now a question to each of the panelists who haven't spoken, and these were actually addressed, at least the first couple were addressed specifically to the people I'm going to. For David Keane, when you compare the World Trade Center and Pentagon terrorist attacks with the US-UK bombing campaign in Afghanistan, do you not accept a qualitative moral differentiation founded on, one, intentionally using hundreds of civilians as flying bombs to intentionally murder thousands of civilians, and two, on the other hand, a bombing campaign that intentionally differentiates the Afghanistan civilian population from the Taliban and Al-Qaeda training camps? So do you, I think it actually means, don't you accept that there's a moral difference between these two actions?
Yeah. I'm not too sure about that. I do accept that there has been an attempt, as far as one can tell, to minimize civilian casualties in the bombing of Afghanistan. A lot of these things depend on how you are going to define civilian casualties. Now, we do know that according to the United Nations, something like 7.5 million people are facing starvation in Afghanistan. We know that the winter is very close at hand. We know that food convoys have had to be stopped for the duration of military action. And we know that the rations that have been dropped from airplanes are very, very tiny in relation to the need. Now, I do think there is a difference between the knowingly massacring thousands of civilians in the World Trade Center and the kind of if you like the banalization of evil that's involved in allowing people to die through the through knowingly disrupting and preventing a humanitarian operation. But there are a lot of differences. I don't really feel qualified to sort of weigh up the relative amounts of evil in these different things, although a lot of people, a lot of people clearly do. I think one of the differences that would be most commonly cited as making the bombing of the destruction of the World Trade Center far worse than what's going on in Afghanistan is the idea that this bombing of Afghanistan is a retaliation. Okay, it's a retaliation against something which has already happened. But I think that the more one examines processes of violence in any context, and it's not just this one, the more one realizes that for those who are carrying out the violence, their actions are themselves a retaliation, and they have a whole different set of abuses. I'm talking in general terms, which people who carry out violence will normally cite as justification for what they do. And somewhere along the line of this process of mutual retaliation and everybody feeling that their violence is righteous, then I think somebody has to say, well, maybe we need to stop this, and we need to stop doing the kinds of things that are going to generate in future generations the perception that their violence continues to be righteous, and we need to stop giving them the grounds for future retaliations.
Thank you, David. Maybe carrying on from there to Halle Afshar, assuming war is a way to generate more violence, what do you think would have been the best or right response from the USA and the Western world to terrorism?
Well, taking David King's point, I actually think not giving ground. And I do think that there's some kind of ahistorical view. You know, this happened. Things don't happen in a vacuum. And I do think that we have to think as to what actually constitutes the kind of ground that they were talking about. Why would people think it's worth giving up their lives? What is the cause? And what is actually the history of the United States' role in the Middle East? Why would... it was very interesting. All kinds of very good American friends of mine were going around asking why they were not being loved. And it's not that we in the Middle East don't love particular Americans, but we definitely hate the American state policy as far as the Middle East is concerned for a whole century. And I actually think that, you know, things accumulate. In the particular case of Afghanistan, I think that there was... it would have been very wise to have made haste much more slowly. I think that the bombings is very good for the rating of President Bush, but it really does not help the Afghans, and it could have been much slower.
Thank you. Denise, this person asks, I take this as a somehow representative forum of the UK's academic views of the issue. Being that the case, I wonder how come it is that these neutral positions towards the problem do not reflect in the primetime media at all. By neutral, I mean there's been no position in the panel which fully supports U.S. recent reaction.
And you want me to address this?
Yeah.
right. Well, I mean, obviously, the media have to represent a particular point of view, and academic freedom demands that we represent points of view that we believe to be correct and that we believe in. That, I think, is the major distinction. Having said that, however, I will agree with something. I think that there is a degree of hypocrisy at work, and we have to come clean about the feeling of having one's stomach stirred to the point of wanting to vomit when you see crowds cheering at the news that people have been massacred by two planes somewhere. It is actually a very, very painful thing. However, having said that, I want to really focus the minds on something else, which makes the response that much harder, a sensible response. Because in reality, what we're dealing with is a police operation This is not something that can be done with tanks and bombs, because we're talking about networks, transnational networks of finance, criminality, and drugs. Okay? This is the stuff of police covert operations, not the stuff of tanks and armies, etc. In other words, we're handling the issue wrong. The question is, yes, a dreadful thing has happened. Is war, bombing, an effective means of dealing with that particular problem? That is the question. I think questions about what's more morally outrageous, people starving or people being, you know, innocent people being killed by planes. These are besides the point, as indeed I fear, is the shape of a coming government in Afghanistan. Because this, I'm afraid, is not about Afghanistan. This, as you have quite correctly said, listen to Bin Laden, he has nothing to say about Afghanistan. This is and has always been about destabilizing the Middle East and unseating the current holders of power in Egypt, in Jordan, in Syria, in Algeria. The major fallout of this whole business has been the return of the Afghan Arabs to their respective countries, all dressed up with nowhere to go. They created the situation we know in Algeria. The cost in human lives has been catastrophic. It has created a very repressive regime in Egypt. And now the United States is in a very difficult position because they know it's about ousting the sultans in Saudi Arabia, and they cannot afford that. And the point is, how did we get there? This is a question we have to ask. And this is where I find myself really feeling rather desperate. For a long time before I exiled myself to another region, I was a Middle East scholar. And while people were talking about multiculturalism, postmodernity, and so on, I was being extremely isolated and unpopular, saying, make no mistake, this is a bid for state power. This is taking over the interstices that you were talking about, left by the vacuum created by secular politics. This is not about anything else. Now this horrible prediction is coming back in full force. I am quite sure that Islamic politics in the Middle East was never simply about indigenous people expressing themselves, because I knew full well that the creation of the Islamic networks have always been part of the war of communism in my region. I come from Turkey, and since the 1950s, the United States has been sponsoring organizations which have also been funded by Saudi Arabia. The reason why it didn't go very far is that there is a very strong army which maintains the monopoly of violence with great force, for which we are very thankful, I must add. Okay? So we must absolutely know this is the time to shed all form of hypocrisy and to stop talking about moral indignation here and there and to really come clean about this. What has happened is horrific. People dancing in the streets turns my stomach. But we have to go right back to how the Afghan Arabs made their trail back into the region with predictably disastrous consequences. And this is why it's going to be very difficult to reconstruct. Because societies which have been corrupted through and through with criminality cannot generate legitimate outcomes overnight. Let us not kid ourselves. And I have to end on this pessimistic note, I'm afraid.
Let me take up another aspect of this that was raised by a couple of the speakers. The panel has made little mention of the war against women in Afghanistan since the Taliban took control. Did the West not miss an opportunity in not viewing the war against women as a powerful group oppressing another group, like the international community did with apartheid in South Africa and in the Balkans? Or going on, what are the implications of this conflict on gender roles and women's rights in Afghanistan? Helle, do you want to?
Oh, sorry, I thought it was all for John.
No.
The answer is yes, yes, and yes. I think that the difficulty has been that whereas all Afghan politics has been the domain of intervention, the question of women has always been shelved in that kind of initial criteria that I said I disliked intensely of cultural identity. And also, as Zahra said, is actually also been about the alliances that women have had with the left, the politics of the left, which actually recognize them as having a right. I mean, a very, very long time ago, I argued that the difficulty with Afghanistan was that anyone from the 1920s onward, anyone who gave women their rights was immediately deposed, either by external forces or by alliances between external forces and internal forces. And I think the other point to actually bear in mind is that in the case of Afghanistan, and I'm very willing to be corrected, but it's only in the cities that women are put undercover, women are pushed under. In all of the Middle East, you can't actually exclude the women because they are actually making a living, and you can't make a living without using your hand and without actually being out there. But of course, the women who are making a living are poor, they don't have a political voice, and in fact the battle for survival is such that they actually can't have representation at the UN level and seek protection. So I think that there's been a difficulty in terms of political allegiances that women have made, and also in terms of the problem that women have of gaining access to power, which is very difficult. But I do think that there is an alliance still between women, and we shouldn't underestimate the resilience of even urban Afghani women who continued to have illegal schools in their home, who continued to risk their own lives in order to secure the liberation of women. And I really salute them. I think they have been fantastic.
James, I'll just pick up on that issue as well. I mean, I think that the women issue with regards to Taliban is it's the big hot potato in that sense, because it's, I don't know, there are so many issues conflated into one. But one of the first points to make is the sense in which the Taliban as an organization of 50,000 people controlling towns and roads, there's a quote about government in Afghanistan that it hovers like a spaceship above the people. So I think as much as the Taliban are justifiably vilified for some of the edicts which they have come out with, which I've worked on as well, I think to a large degree there's a rural-urban split going on. And for many women, Afghan women in Afghanistan, the Taliban do not impinge directly in the sense of an enforcement of an edict restricting their employment, because communities are immune to some degree or other from central government. And I think that this point is missed. It's also missing the subtlety, I would think. There are nuances to the Taliban's position on women. And I think it's something to do with Afghan culture, perhaps, and the discreet way in which difficult issues are handled. And with FMF, the Feminist Majority Foundation in America, making a lot of noise about this, if you become very vitriolic in a pro-gender scenario, you will also encourage the hawks on the other side from the Taliban. So if you look at the example of the NGO Swedish Committee for Afghanistan, they made some progress under the Taliban in rural areas on the issues of female employment and healthcare, but it was done in a very discreet, below-the-horizon fashion. I just think when you're dealing with the Taliban and you're dealing with a fairly vitriolic organization, the more confrontational you are over an issue, the more you will meet that face coming back at you, and the more you miss the opportunities at a middle to lower level. But again, this falls victim to higher levels of debate over Islam and the West, misperceptions within the West in terms of Islam, and it goes on. I just thought I'd add that.
It's important.
Yeah, please speak right into the mic. Yeah.
Okay. Right.
Thank you.
About women and Taliban policies towards women in Afghanistan, it's not, I don't think.
Yeah. Okay. Speak right into it.
I don't think to blame Afghan culture for what is happening in Afghanistan.
Absolutely.
There is not question of a few hundred. Okay. Sorry.
They're not as good as the mics at the BBC.
Our mics. Very. I don't think the question is about few hundred educated liberal women in the cities which were deprived from education and work, and in the other part of Afghanistan people are doing, women are working or living as they did. I think at least the question is about 10,000 women in different cities who are deprived from working and education. Then it is not the only phenomenon. I think the women were seen or are seen as a second sort citizens who are who have no rights, who have no social rights, political rights, and who have who are lost all normal rights in Afghanistan. I was in Afghanistan, and I think even in the very remote, I left Afghanistan in 1990, at the beginning of 90s. In the remote villages, you could see schools, places where women work. Of course, it is a country with two cultures, the city's culture and the rural culture, the village's culture. What happened, this village's culture dominated in the Afghan political and social scene. And this orphans of madrasa came with no knowledge of women and with their phobia against women. I think there are, I don't want to reject all ideas you said. Maybe there was some reasons for the Taliban, but nothing can justify what happened to the Afghan women who are the majority of Afghan population. Other thing, I think the feminist majority played very, very important role in rising the awareness of people in the West. Mm-hmm. Despite criticism here in Europe that these are a group doing something for their own benefits. But I think they at least help Hillary Clinton to think that there are Afghan women and other women in the United States. I think they played an important role.
Thank you.
I just want very briefly to say, as I said at the beginning of my talk, I'm allergic to cultural definitions. There is nothing about us Muslim women that make us submissive. And there's nothing about my... And there is absolutely nothing about Muslim men that gives them the right to do what the Taliban are doing. It's a misinterpretation of the Quran, it's a misinterpretation of the Islam, and it's a very clear example of patriarchy, and that's a universal culture. So
okay, I have time for only one more question, despite this pile here of very interesting questions, and I think we will try to do something with the questions. But let me just put this question and give each person on the panel who wants to a last chance to say something. It is unfortunate that it took a horrible terrorist attack on the World Trade Center, a crime against all of humanity, for the international community, especially America, to take notice of a problem that has affected millions of people worldwide, from Israeli-occupied Palestine to Nicaragua. Why? It's a general question that allows you to give your last word. Why did it take?
Well, it's a big question. But I mean, I suppose one of the few things which seems to have been somewhat encouraging in the last few weeks has been the fact that the United States has, I said grudgingly and very, very belatedly, rather changed its position and recognized the rights of Palestinians to their own state. But you know, why has it taken these terrible events to bring about this change of view? Some questioning, at least, of long pursued policies. Well, I mean, it seems to me that it is because of the one. We've touched on this at different points. The very powerful economic interests which are involved, especially in the Middle East, and which have led Western powers to intervene in particular ways and to seek to push aside the problem of Palestine as actually just sort of getting in the way of the kinds of relationships which it's necessary for Western companies and Western states to have with those countries which surround the Gulf and which control the oil. Of course, the domination of the media by those same interests also play a part in this, and it's taken these extraordinary events to shake up long accepted policy thinking in the Pentagon and in Whitehall.
Matthew,
very brief.
Yeah, as we've come to the end of our time.
Very brief. I mean, I think in terms of the prospects for Afghanistan on the back of this renewed American interest, I would hope that you know, when Tony Blair says we're interested, we won't forget you this time, I would hope that there is a sustained interest in Afghanistan. But as Denise rightly said, this issue is bigger than Afghanistan, and Afghanistan suffers for this issue. Whether, once again, Afghanistan, the context in which militant Arabs were targeted by America in 2001 is forgotten by 2005, I think it's a possibility. I don't see the Americans looking beyond it, and that's not to fall into the argument that America or whoever has to reconstruct Afghanistan. But I think there were some very good initiatives already underway that have been complicated by the bombing, which could still be built upon.
Thank you. David.
I'm not... why has it taken so long? I think the... having lived in America for a while, I think there you do get a sense there that, to some extent, world events are not going to... that you have some degree of immunity to world events, and that security threats are something that happen somewhere else. So I think that's one of the reasons why this act of terrorism in New York and Washington has such a dramatic effect. I do think that there are some legitimate interests among, for example, Israelis. Fearing that the groups that seek to abolish to abolish Israel, and clearly the Jewish lobby is powerful in America, and this is a big part of the reason why it's taken so long to for such a dramatic change. So I mean, that's a rather I'm just trying to answer the question.
I'm cutting you off now, but thank you. Yes. Zahir.
Again, Afghanistan.
Just in a couple sentences.
You mean I was...
Because we have to wrap up.
Okay. I would like only to add to what I said, that stopping terrorist activities in Afghanistan that I believe centered in this country cannot be done with purely diplomatic efforts at this moment, cannot be done without removing the Taliban regime, and cannot be done without engaging in an effective post-Taliban arrangement in Afghanistan. Without a stable government in Afghanistan, the threat is always there.
Thank you. Denise.
Okay.
Absolutely. I agree too.
Okay. I want to thank you all for coming this afternoon and thank our panelists. And I do hope that you'll continue to come to the activities of the Development Studies Institute and the Crisis States Program when we put on activities like this. So thank you very much. And I do apologize for any questions we didn't answer. Thank you.